crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nuchtiger. We are coming to you today from Jerusalem, Israel. Thank you very much to Christopher Eames for covering last week's program, in which he talked about the biblical pre-flood longevity, basically just the ages in which people lived to back before the flood. And I thought it was just fascinating, extremely interesting. If you enjoyed that program, he has written an article about that, following up on it. Goes into more detail than he was able to go into in his program, and this is something that you definitely want to prove for yourself. So please check in with Watch Jerusalem, the website, on Tuesday, when I'm going to be publishing the article related to that program. I'd also encourage you to go ahead and read his really long article about Canaan versus Israel. It's entitled Canaan versus Israel, Helpless Natives Against Evil Imperialist Power? And he really does address the takeover of the promised land, the land of Canaan, based on what the biblical text actually says, rather than our interpretation of it, at least a lot of what of how people today, people in the modern era, are interpreting that takeover. So go back and read that article. I'll leave links for the articles as well in the show notes today. Before we get started onto the topic that I'm going to cover, that is bees and their biblical connection in relation to the excavation at Tel Rehov, I want to give some feedback. And first of all, a piece of feedback related to Chris's article. This is on Facebook, and this was in relation to his article about Canaan versus Israel. Neil Dyer said this: excellent. I'm going to keep this handy when I'm reading my Bible. So that was pretty encouraging to read her say that. Michael Shapiro wrote this: idiots. Imperialism is a term coined only in the 20th century because values about war and conquest changed. You can't judge the past by the values of the present. Everyone in the past was conquering everybody. That's the way it was. So while that in many cases, in many instances, is true, definitely the article, if you go back and read it, and if he goes back and reads it, you'll see how it really does present an accurate portrayal of the biblical text and how the Canaan was taken over. In response to another article on Facebook, we published Germany and Russia's secret war against America. This was written by our editor-in-chief, something that is very critical to understand right now in relation to the close partnership that Germany and Russia have, and how that is often a prelude to much greater conflict. And of course, we base that on history, but also Bible prophecy as well. And anyway, this Israeli responds: Bible prophecies, ha! And then he says, are you out of your mind? That is, of course, if you have one. So obviously this is a little bit negative. But then he says this: no way Germany will leave NATO, as NATO's main land power in Europe is German. Furthermore, Europe is Germany. And so it's really interesting to see what he wrote. He really disapproves of our use of the Bible or Bible prophecy and basing our analysis of these events. And yet he talks about something that is what we've been saying for decades and decades, a truism that is based on the Bible and based on Bible prophecy, that Europe right now is being dictated to by Germany. Europe is Germany, he writes. And so I thought that was pretty interesting. Another comment from Israel relating to that article: interesting analysis. It's plausible and occurring at a moment where the other European powers, such as Britain and France, are fading, which gives more credibility to this. And then it says they begun like this in 1940. Speaking of Germany and Russia, well, it does go back even to 1939 and even to many instances of collusion between Germany and Russia and back and deals that took place before greater war was on the horizon. Anyway, there is some feedback for you. If you'd like to send your feedback to the program, you can do so by writing your emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. We do receive emails to that email address, and also you can respond on Facebook and other social media as well. Got a request from I think it was Brazil today to start translating some of our articles into Portuguese to put on their website, just because they feel like they are valuable to get out in that language. So I thought that was interesting as well. But as I said, today I want to talk about bees and their biblical connection in relation to the excavation at Tel Rehov. Tel Rehov is located in the Beit Shan Valley, towards the northeast of Israel, below the Sea of Galilee, and just south of Beit Shan. It's on one of the main north-south routes which traverse the Jordan Valley, both anciently and today, going from the northern part of the Dead Sea, or even, the northern part of the Dead Sea up to the Sea of Galilee, the Kinneret, as well. This Tel Rehov is located to fertile land, water sources, and excavations took place there from 1997 to 2012, and they revealed a lot of findings from the really key biblical period of the 10th century and the 9th century. This city, Tel Rehov, was one of the largest in biblical Israel during this 100 years, from the 10th to 9th century, around the end of King Solomon's reign onwards. And the final reports of those excavations have just been published relatively quick after the excavations. They were published by Professor Amahar Mazar. I had the chance to talk with him at our reception that we had for the opening of the seals of Isaiah and King Hezekiah. Discovered that exhibit. I talked to him at the opening in June 10th in Jerusalem about this massive amount of work that it is to produce these final reports on the excavations, and he was a little bit discouraged, just felt like they might not be read as much as he would like. And yet we are going to read part of one today, because I feel it's incredibly important and very fascinating as well. So discovered at this location in Tel Rehov, it'd be good to get a map out just so you know exactly where it is, just a bit below Beit Shan, was a large bee apiary, or a massive place where they had lots of beehives. And as he wrote in this report, again, I'll leave a link to this as well that you can read if you like, this was far more than just domestic production. It wasn't just a couple of beehives for the use of the person producing it, but it was for commercial production, both the honey that would come from it, and then also the beeswax, as we'll cover as well, which was used. And this does have probably biblical significance. Obviously, the land of Israel was called this land flowing with milk and honey. That's how it was referred to so often. But as he talks about in this paper, when it refers to milk and honey, a lot of that is not necessarily the honey that comes from bees, but the honey that actually comes from dates and figs and such. Nevertheless, the discovery of such a large apiary here really does prove that this was an industry taking place in Israel just after or around the time of Solomon, and into the time of, or close to the time of Elijah, close to the Omride dynasty there in the northern Israel. Based on carbon dates from this apiary, this was dated to the 10th and 9th century, and he says it was used in the early decades, of the 10th century, so that's the early 900s, and then into the late 800s. And he says this means around the same time as the end of the Solomonic era and the early kings of the northern kingdom of Israel. And this is what he writes, quote, at the beginning. "This is the only apiary to be found in an archaeological site in the ancient Near East and the Eastern Mediterranean world. In this article, I discuss this exceptional discovery of an industrial apiary and its implications to the early history of beekeeping." So all you beekeepers out there, this is something that's been going on for a long, long, long time. This is the only one that's been found in this area of ancient Israel. There have been many more that have been discovered all over the world from thousands of years before this. So this was around for a long, long time. But this is the only one that's been found in Israel, and it still dates to around 3,000 years ago. Now, in this apiary. There was about 30 beehives that were uncovered. And while there would have been so much more than this in there at the time, 30 were still left pretty much intact. And each individual hive, as he writes, was made by with unbaked clay, a mixture of straw with straw, and it was shaped into a hollow cylinder, measuring 80 centimeters in length, 40 centimeters in diameter, and it had a 4 centimeter thick wall, and it had a volume of 56 liters. And I'll leave a picture to this. These cylindrical beehives, ancient beehives made of clay and straw, in the show notes that you can click on and see a picture. At one of the ends of the cylinder, it was closed by a clay wall, and then you had this small flying hole, he calls it, about 2 to 4 centimeters in diameter, so basically an inch. And this is where the bees would enter and exit the hive and also keep unwanted animals away. The opposite end of the cylinder was fitted with a portable clay lid with a handle that could be removed, of course, to get the honey out and to get the honeycomb out as well. He writes here that they were arranged in a kind of a lattice kind of structure, and there was a broad aisles in between the different rows that these hives were stacked in, so that there was some type of industrial process going on. You need to walk in between them. And together, he said, the apiary could comprise about 180 hives. So this is substantial. 180 hives, if their math is correct. And if he bases it that his numbers, though, on just having 100 hives, so he picks somewhere in the middle. So it's probably more than this. But based on that, each one of these hives could produce about 3 to 5 kilos of honey annually. And then if there's around 100 hives, that's about 500 kilos of honey, or 300 to 500 kilos of honey. And that's off 100 hives. So if there were 180, we're definitely getting up to 500 kilograms of honey each year, as well as almost 100 kilos of beeswax. And so he's saying, well, this obviously is more than just private consumption. And so this was a profitable enterprise throughout Telrakov's history. And indeed, looking at the context of what was happening at the time that this was in use, it definitely looks like this would be a commodity that could be sold. Definitely sold for a substantial amount of money because of the different construction that was taking. Let's put it that way at this point. We'll get to that in a second. Now, what's interesting also about this discovery is that they actually discovered one of the 3,000-year-old bees inside one of these hives. It was put under an electron microscope. And then when they did that, by looking at the different appendages that were left of the bee, something very interesting was discovered. Instead of it being one of the normal bees from the area here in Israel or southern Syria, it looks like it was an imported bee. This is what he writes, Emma Hamizah. The evidence was consistent with the anatomy of the subspecies Anatolian honeybee, and unlike that of the Syrian honeybee, which is typical to the southern Levant. The Anatolian honeybee is particularly productive and easier to raise for commercial purposes than the aggressive Syrian bee, and is presently at the base of the Turkish honey industry, the second largest in the world. And so this same bee in Turkey right now is being used to create its honey, creating an industry which is the second largest in the world of any other nation. But it was imported probably from Anatolia, so Turkish region, about 500 kilometers for use in Tel Rahov. And so I just think this is interesting because we have this view of what was taking place 3,000 years ago on the earth, and surely they couldn't have the access to the different transportation means that we have, which they didn't. And yet they were still able to transport a large quantity of these bees hundreds and hundreds of kilometers away, and they knew that it was worth their while to do this. It's interesting also that we do have a parallel account of a similar type of action taking place. This is in Assyria, and this is dating to the first half of the 8th century. So about 150 years after the Tel Rehov Apari. And this relates to the Assyrian governor of Suhu, and this was around the middle Euphrates region, modern time. This is in southeastern Syria. And he boasts, the governor here, of being able to, well, he was the first one amongst his ancestors to have successfully bred these bees that he imported from elsewhere. This is an inscription, an Assyrian inscription from around 750 BCE. This is what it says. I am Shamash-resh-Usher, the governor of Suhu in the land of Mari. Bees that collect honey, which none of my ancestors had ever seen or brought into the land of Suhu, I brought them down from the men of Habha and made them settle in the orchards of the town of Geberbiltet. And they collected honey and wax, and I know how to melt the honey and wax, and the gardeners know too. It's a pretty interesting here, this account from 2,750 years ago. This man boasting of his ability to bring these bees from about 400 kilometers away to where he was located. And it looks like, considering where he got them from, the mountains of Iran, the Eastern Taurus Mountains, these were probably the same type of bees that existed in Tel Rehov, that were imported to Tel Rehov. So that's a little bit about the bees and the hives themselves from Tel Rehov. Now let's get into some parts of how this could really relate and how it does relate to the Bible. Now, inside this apiary, there was a storage jar that was found bearing the inscription Lamed Nun Mem Shin, belonging to Nimshi, basically, is how it would be translated into English. This was found in the apiary. And this is interesting because Nimshi is a very important name that appears numerous times in the Bible. There have been other inscriptions from places extremely close to Tel Rehov that have the word Nimshi on them also, or the name Nimshi, from this exact period, the 10th to 9th century. And here we've got the name Nimshi again on a vessel belonging to the vessel saying belonging to Nimshi inside this apiary. And so it's likely that Nimshi, or the family Nimshi, was in control of this apiary, which would have been a substantial source of income for Tel Rehov at the very end of the 10th century, start of the 9th century. Now, who is this Nimshi? We don't know exactly. We don't know for sure who Nimshi is. But at this same time, alive at this same time, there is a biblical Nimshi who was alive in this same location. Same location. Nimshi is mentioned in the Bible as the father or grandfather of Jehu. And Jehu, of course, he was the founder of the dynasty who rose to power after the fall of the Omri dynasty. He became king in 842 BCE after he killed Jehoram, I believe it was, the son of Ahab. Remember Ahab, the Omri dynasty was to be destroyed, and Jehu was used by God to destroy it. 1 Kings 19 verse 16 says this. This is where we're first introduced to this man Jehu, who is the son of Nimshi, as it says there. And this is the account that Elisha has needed to escape from Ahab down to Horeb, and God is revealing to him to basically, don't worry, there's still supporters out there. You're not alone, and I want you to go back and do two things. And 1 Kings 19 and verse 16 says this, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shall you anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, shalt you anoint to be prophet in your room. So it's interesting here. You've got two individuals that are linked together, Elisha and Jehu. And this Jehu, it says, is the son of Nimshi. Now we can go over to 2 Kings 9 and verse 2 and see that Jehu was actually the grandson of Nimshi. He was probably born, this Jehu was probably born a decade or two after this apiary was in use. But his grandfather, Nimshi, would have been alive definitely at the time that the apiary was in use. And so we have Nimshi in the Bible operating around this area. and we have a Nimshi here on written on a vessel of the same time period that this apiary was in use, saying that the contents of this vessel belonged to Nimshi or came from Nimshi. So really, if we go back to this biblical description of Elijah being told by God to anoint this man, Jehu, why mention Nimshi? Why not mention his father? His father's name was Jehoshaphat. It's because Nimshi was more important. Nimshi was the important figure. Now, it's interesting also that Jehu would not be anointed by Elijah. He would be anointed at the time of Elisha, Elijah's successor. And even then, it would be done by one of Elisha's followers, a son of the prophet, which relates to Tel Rehov as well, as we'll get to. This is what Amahamizah says in his report. The threefold recurrence of the name in the same region during the same time period leads to the assumption that the Nimshi family was one of influence and prominent status at Tel Rehov, which may have also been the family's seat, being the largest and most significant city in the region during this period. Moreover, we suggest that the Nimshi family may have also been the one to build the apiary and profit from it. So here we've got a biblical figure, Nimshi, with a number of inscriptions in this area having his name on them, one of them being found inside this apiary, and being that this was the largest city at this time of any of them that are around here, makes sense that this was where the family was located. And if that's the case, this is probably the town where Jehu grew up as well. Why not? It makes sense. It makes sense, especially related to Elisha, as we'll get to. Now, there was another interesting clay object found inside the apiary. And he writes about this. Amahamizah writes about this as well. He says, the significance of the apiary is also evident from the cultic rituals that were carried out within its confines. Then he describes a specific artifact that they discovered, a four-horned altar that was decorated with two naked females, perhaps, he writes, fertility goddesses, that were flanking an incised tree. And then he says the cult practices must have been intended to increase the yield of the apiary. Now this, and again, I'll show you a picture of it. If you're online listening to this, you can see a picture of it. But this looks to be a common practice of the day, that inside such a apiary, or where you had production of something that you cared a lot about, you needed to pray to your gods, you need to offer to your gods. And it's likely that on this altar, they offered honey inside this apiary as well. And it looks like this was a common pagan practice of the day. How do we know this? Well, there was a specific law against doing this. Leviticus chapter 2 and verse 11 says this: no grain offering that you bring to the Eternal shall be made with leaven, for you shall burn no leaven nor any honey as a food offering unto the Eternal. So a lot of these laws we saw were given because the other people around Israel at the time did them, and so God wanted to keep the worship of Him separate completely, and so that they wouldn't worship God in a pagan way, as human beings are always prone to do. And so, remarkably, there is this biblical law that forbids an offering to contain honey. And here we have an apiary. In the middle of that apiary, we have an altar, likely for burning honey. So this is indicative, that there were these incorrect religious practices taking place inside this city at this time, and that they thought that it would further the industry. Now, it doesn't mean that it was always like this, but at some point, and definitely when the building was destroyed, you had this practice taking place, a practice that the Bible specifically forbade. Now, it's interesting that in a matter of decades after this apiary was in use, we have another startling discovery that was made at Tel Rehov. So 20, 30 years after we have the apiary being destroyed, which contained this pagan altar, we have another discovery. This took place in one of the last seasons of the excavation there at Tel Rehov. And this was a piece of pottery that had ancient text written on it in red ink. This wasn't Nimshi this time. This was found within a layer that dated to the middle of the 9th century. So about 50 years, or less than 50 years, 30 to 50 years. And the ancient Hebrew script that was written on it was damaged, and yet it still could be translated with near certainty to the name of Elisha. Elisha. We have a text on a piece of pottery from this town of Rehov, a couple decades after this time that the apiary was destroyed, with the name Elisha on it. Now, this is interesting for a number of reasons. Not only does the name parallel the biblical account, it also dates to the same time period in which Elisha lived as well, and it's found in an area where he spent a lot of his time. Elisha the prophet was only born about 7 miles away in a town, Abel Meholah, as even we read before, when God told Elijah to go and anoint him. And the Bible says that Elisha spent so much time around this area that a couple living in nearby Shunem were inspired to make a chamber for him in their house. He was coming by so often. You can see that in 2 Kings 4 at the beginning. He was coming so often by this area, by Tel Rehov, back to his own home, that this area of Shunem, which you can see in the book of Joshua, is just right here in this valley, that a couple are like, why don't we'll just make a little space for you in our house. Let's make a little room, put that in it, and you can come and stay with us whenever you come by. So it seems extremely plausible also that Elisha was at Tel Rehov. He was at Tel Rehov. And we have an inscription there with his name on it. And the name Elisha, especially at this time, is rare. It's rare. It's not like an everyday name. And so what are the chances, same time, same place, that it's a different Elisha? Makes sense that we have a historical tradition, the Bible, that says that Elisha was there at this time. Why not? Can this shard with the inscription, this ostraca, be Elisha's himself? Now, this is interesting, and I'm just speculating here. Because the apiary was destroyed eventually for some reason, initially it was thought by the excavators that the apiary was destroyed with the rest of the city from that time. But it was found out that it was just the apiary that was destroyed. Just this one building in the middle of this massive town, burnt to the ground. And allowed to burn to the ground, as Amahai Mazar writes. He says this, it is difficult to assess how long the beehives were in use. They did, however, meet their end in a fierce conflagration of fire, and structures that were completely different in plan were constructed on their ruins in the subsequent stratum. So at some point, destroyed by fire, fiercely. And the new building, totally different, on the ruins. He continues, the destruction of the apiary and the fact that it was not subsequently reconstructed indicate that it was considered extraneous to the city's life. We are done with the bees. We are done with the producing of the honey and the wax. Let's destroy it and move on. And he writes this, evidence from a paleomagnetic study conducted by Dr. Erez Ben Yosef indicates a possibility that it was an earthquake that destroyed the area of the apiary, starting a fire and bringing down the mud brick walls surrounding the apiary. But just the apiary, I think that is just a crazy option that this one place was impacted by by this earthquake, setting off a fire, destroying just this building, but not the other ones next to it down. Then he continues, as mentioned above, radiocarbon dates from this area point to a date at the close of the 10th century or the beginning of the 9th century. In any event, it seems that many commoners in the city were happy to see the apiary in flames. Interesting. Now, he doesn't put it together any more than that. And he kind of says that, well, maybe it was annoying to have all these bees flying around. They're finally like, I'm done getting stung. Let's stop this beehive practice. I mean, that is an option for sure. But I think it might have been something different. And I'm speculating here. But just looking at what was about to take place in this city, and given the fact that there was a pagan altar built and used inside this apiary and found in the destruction of this apiary, and the fact that the commoners of the city were happy to see it in flames, they did not try to put it out. It's like they contained the fire just to this one building, and then left it, and then built something totally different on top of it. Now, why not stop it from burning to the ground, especially with honey in it? There's still honey found in there. There was still honey, and there was still the wax inside the hives. No, it was just left and burnt, and just that building. Maybe, possibly, it had some connection to the fact that there was a pagan practice going on there. A few decades later, we have the name Elisha appearing in an inscription, and given that Elijah was close to here, and that Elisha lived close to here, maybe this was a location of a bit of a spiritual revival during the early 9th century. Elijah was close, Elisha lived close, we have his inscription there, and then this apiary is burned to the ground just before that time. Now, I don't know for sure, but I certainly think that this could have been part of it. I mean, Elisha did likely live in this city for a time, and if this was the place, as Mr. Amahai Mazar says, where the family of Nimshi had its base, the largest tell in the region here, where we've got Nimshi being found all over the place, it's also possible that Jehu grew up in this city. That Jehu, who would eventually be king, who would eventually, even though he was evil, go around destroying idols of Baal for a time. Why did he do that? Where did he learn that? Now, maybe some of the sons of Nimshi had a bit of a turn for the better. Maybe the prominence of Elisha and Elijah in this area rubbed off on some of the common folk in this city, as Amahai Mazar calls him, commoners in the city, and that were happy to see this apiary burning to the ground. Why do you destroy something in your own city and let it burn to the ground and then just be done with it? Not try and go in there and rescue some of these vessels containing the honey. Maybe it was to do that the people wanted to move on. And the fact that Elisha would come across and start living in towns like this and dropping in on places like this often, maybe it means that the people there actually responded. There were 7,000. That's what Elijah was told by God on Horeb. There were 7,000 that still haven't bowed their knee to Baal. Makes sense for Elisha to be working with those 7,000 in this area. Again, what I'm saying is all speculatory because we don't know for sure. But it's certainly possible. And it's an example of how these archaeological discoveries can really illustrate the biblical text and add some more color to it as well. Now, there is one other point I'd like to draw our attention to from this report. And that is why there was a honey industry in the first place. Now, the timing of it's very interesting concerning what was happening around the same time, just a little bit further towards the south of Tel Rehov. Now, I read this morning another article, a different one. This was published by Erez Ben Yosef and Aaron Greener. They recently wrote a piece for at thetorah.com that was summarizing their discoveries in the Timna Valley in the very south of Israel. This is where those massive copper mines were found. And they were found, these copper mines were in use during the reign of King Solomon. It was like the likely location or a likely location for the copper, of where the copper came from that was going to be used in the temple construction and for his palace, no doubt. Now, this area, as the other article brings out, and I'll leave a link to that as well, this was an industry in these mines in the south of Israel that was staffed and led by the Edomites. So the Israelites don't look like they were working there as the everyday grunts at all. And this was Edomite territory before David. But we read in the Bible how David subjugated the Edomites in this territory. He set up garrisons in Edom. And so these copper mines were inside the territory that David conquered and that Solomon would come to hold power over. And so you had these mines that were digging out copper. And this is going to be used, obviously, in order to produce copper and bronze objects for the temple, which they were a lot of. And with that in mind, we'll come back to this apiary. And I'm going to talk about a theory that Professor Amahai made, that maybe these beehives weren't just used for their honey. Maybe it was the wax that have been the most important output. Wax was a critical component of the manufacture of copper objects. And again, it's around the same time period. This is what he writes. As we know, the large-scale copper mines at Kiribat and Nahas, this is from the other side of the Jordan Valley, basically, in modern-day Jordan, at the foot of the Edom mountain range in Jordan, and Timna, which is what I was talking about before, in the Arafah Valley, were operating on an unprecedented scale during the 10th century and the first half of the 9th centuries, which correspond with the activity of our apiary. So they were working hard, digging up all this this copper, had these smelting facilities there with the copper ore, and this is just when our apiary was running. Could it be that the industrial, he writes, Amahamizar, could it be that industrial apiaries of the type found in Tel Rehov served a copper industry that existed somewhere in the Kingdom of Israel? Biblical tradition tells of the splendid copper utensils installed in Solomon's temple in Jerusalem. And then he quotes 1 Kings 7:46, which says this, "The king had them cast in the ground in the plain of the Jordan between Sukkot and Zarethan." He says Sukkot and Zarethan are identified as sites in the central Jordan Valley, 30 to 35 kilometers south of Tel Rehov. Even if the story does not, even if the story does not faithfully reflect historical reality, it may echo a historical memory about a metal industry that existed during the period in the central Jordan Valley, not far from Tel Rehov. While this is an intriguing hypothesis, it cannot be proved. It's a very intriguing hypothesis. You have all the way in the south, you have the mines, and then you have Tel Rehov in the north, well, just below the Sea of Galilee area in the north, where they are producing this wax, which is incredibly important. Incredibly important. Now, wax was critical in the process. If you've ever watched, I forget what this is called, he mentioned it in his paper, Lost Wax, I think the Lost Wax Process or something like that. It's a way of producing implements out of copper, because you need a negative which you can build out of the wax, and then that can be cast. You can have ceramic cast around that, or kind of ceramic block cast around that, and then you can pour the bronze into. Anyway, it's a big process. I watched a couple of YouTube videos on it. It's really fascinating because they still use this same process today, but in order to create bronze busts. So in order to create these utensils and the dishes and the vessels all out of copper, you need to have a lot of wax. A lot of wax. And beeswax is what was used a lot of the time anciently. And so he says, we have where the copper was dug up. We have Tel Rehov producing a lot of wax. And in between the two, or closer to Tel Rehov, just outside of in the Jordan Valley, across from Jerusalem, we have the Bible saying that this is where those implements were cast. This is where there was need for a lot of copper, and this is where there was a need for a lot of beeswax. And they're all operating at the same time that Solomon's temple is being built. He says this is an intriguing hypothesis. It can't be proved, but it certainly does add up. We have Solomon's temple being built and the prolonged need for those utensils even after it's constructed. We have where the wax was being produced to make the casts, or the initial part of the cast. We have where the copper was being dug up out of the ground. And we have the location where the Bible says that these implements were being made. I would certainly say that it definitely does add up. And so, Mr. Amahamizar, Professor Amahamizar, thank you very much for putting in the time and effort for this part of your report. It is definitely worthwhile and fascinating for us to go through. This history from Tel Rehov is just stunning, especially when you put it alongside the biblical text. The science of archaeology has so much value in bringing the Bible to life. And in many cases, it's actually able to confirm the biblical text as being accurate in what it describes. And that is the case here with Tel Rehov, certainly around this period of Elijah and Elisha. Now, this isn't all that has been revealed through archaeology from this time. The names of at least 11 biblical figures who featured in and around Elisha's life have been discovered. And of those 11, Three are yet to be confirmed with absolute certainty, like the Elisha inscription. But the other figures that have been discovered are absolutely undeniable and have been proven. These figures include King Omri, Ahab, Jehu, Joash. We know that they existed historically from outside the Bible, biblical sources. The Syrian enemies of them as well, Ben-Hadad, Haziel, and Ben-Hadad II, along with Mesha, the Moabite enemy. These are all individuals that feature into the story of Elisha. We're not mentioning all the other discoveries that prove other people from the Bible. Just this one snapshot of this 50 or 60 year period. And we have so much from archaeology that is really substantiating the biblical history and the personalities mentioned in the biblical account. Now, I'm going to leave a link to this paper from Amar Hamazar if you want to read that. I'm also going to read an article written by Christopher Eames that puts the Bible alongside archaeology during this period of Elisha as well. And so you can see the rest of what has been discovered. It would be well worth your time to read it. That's all we have time for today on the program. If you'd like to send some feedback, you can do that by writing your emails to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. Thanks for being with us, and we will see you next week.